fecal transplant for primary treatment of Clostridium difficile infection.
Skipping chemotherapy in breast cancer patients without affecting outcome.
How does it impact medical errors if attending physicians attend rounds?
And changes to colorectal cancer screening.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. This will be posted on June 8th, 2018. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
And welcome back, Rick. You were in France last week. We're so happy you came back safely and had great cycling.
Well, it's good to be back, Elizabeth. Where do you want to start?
Let's turn first to the New England Journal of Medicine, and I will start with, I think this is novel, this study. It's not novel in one respect. It's the fecal transplantation strategy for dealing with Clostridium difficile infection. This is something that I think we've conservatively talked about four or five times in all of our years of podcasting together. In this case, though, it's, I think, the first time that it's been used for primary treatment of C. diff infection rather than after trying antibiotic treatment. So I went ahead and just took a look at what's out there with regard to the current U.S. recommendations. And basically, I found that the U.S. recommendations say, okay, for the first time, we should be treating folks with either vancomycin or phytomoxacin, not metronidazole. And that if people fail that treatment and they have recurrent C. diff infection, then trying fecal transplant is okay. And then, as we know, there are multiple ways of trying fecal transplantation, including fresh fecal specimens, things that are in capsules. So there have been all kinds of strategies with regard to that. In this particular letter in the New England Journal of Medicine, these folks in Norway randomized an admittedly very few number of patients. How many of them are there? 22, I think. 21 patients with primary C. diff infection. And they randomized them to treatment with either metronidazole, which of course is not the first line treatment in the U.S. recommendations right now, or to fresh infusion of fecal material from people who were C. diff negative. And they got some pretty impressive results. They found that the full primary response to the fecal transplantation was observed in 56% in the transplantation group and 45% in the metronidazole group. But then they also had a secondary, after they treated some of these folks with antibiotics, infusion of the fecal material. In this case, they had 78% response. So as primary treatment, this suggests that this might be something that we need to really expand.
You're right, Elizabeth. It's been well studied for secondary treatment. That is, people that aren't responsive to antibiotics, that have a recurrence. And in this particular trial, you're right, it was oral antibiotics versus the fecal microbiota, which were delivered via an enema. And the results in terms of patients with a full response was better with the microbiota treatment than with antibiotics. You hit some of the limitations. This may not be the best antibiotic therapy. And the other is, people are going to have to decide, well, gosh, do I want treatment with an oral pill or in this particular case via an enema? There may be some patient preferences. What the authors do is I highlight the fact this is an initial trial of only 21 patients and it needs to be confirmed in a larger trial. So I'm glad you picked this.
Well, I think we need to absolutely expand this into a larger trial. We've talked about the substantial yick factor relative to this particular strategy for treating C. diff. On the other hand, if we can somehow, right off the get-go, get this infection under control, to me, that sounds like the right thing to do.
Yep, and it's a good proof of concept trial, and I look forward to additional studies following up on this.
Good news. Since we're in NAJM, let's stay there. We're going to also talk about some other good news for women with breast cancer.
This is an interesting study that suggests that we may be able to avoid using chemotherapy in 70,000 women with early stage breast cancer by using a gene expression assay. They looked at over 10,000 women that had early breast cancer. It was hormone receptive. It had not metastasized anywhere, and it was HER2 negative. That is, you wouldn't usually treat it with Herceptin. There are thousands of women across the U.S. that fall into this category. We now know using something called a 21-gene expression assay, looking at the different different genes that regulate growth and how it responds to hormones, we can predict who's at low risk for recurrence, in which case you do not give them chemotherapy, you give them hormone therapy. Who's at high risk, and those people in fact need chemotherapy, but the vast majority of people fall in the intermediate risk. About two-thirds of women, well, do they need chemotherapy? So they focused on that group, half of whom were randomized to receive chemotherapy, the other half were not. And at the end of about 10 years follow-up, the outcomes were the same. 94% of women in both groups were alive, and 84% had no evidence of recurrence of their cancer. This is a great study of how to use gene expression to personalize therapy in women with breast cancer. That's 85% of women you can avoid chemotherapy in early stage breast cancer. The test, relatively inexpensive, it's about $4,000. Medicare covers it, as does many insurance companies as well.
Good news. We like those kinds of trials. Let's turn from here to JAMA Internal Medicine, something I thought was really fascinating. In this case, they were taking a look at, well, if we increase the amount of time that attending physicians spend with residents and interns, can we reduce the rate of medical errors on patients who are hospitalized? I thought this was fascinating. In a large academic medical center, they had 22 attending physicians who began to attend rounds with residents and interns. They did this over 9 months, and they crossed over with regard to when they attended and the groups they attended with. Over that time period, they saw 1,259 patients, and they took a look at, wow, what was the rate of medical errors and a couple other secondary outcomes. The primary outcome, unfortunately, there was not a significant difference in the rate of medical errors in those groups in whom the attendings were there versus those in whom they were not. The things that were not so great: interns spoke less on rounds and reported feeling less efficient and autonomous. And the residents reported that exact same perception. So, I'd like to hear your thoughts about this, Dr. Attending.
For those listeners who aren't familiar how rounds are conducted with trainees, when a patient comes to the hospital and they're a new patient, the supervising attending physician, who has years of experience, will hear about the patient in great detail, examine the patient, oftentimes with a resident and or students in the room, and develop a treatment plan. In subsequent follow-up, the physician doesn't necessarily see the patient. He just gets a verbal report from the resident physician. In this particular case, they did more intensive supervision. You saw every single patient in great detail every single day. It didn't decrease medical errors. It just made it a less satisfying experience for the residents and interns. This was done at a Harvard institution. These residents are cream of the crop, and it may be that the additional supervision really isn't necessary. Whether this will be transferable to other programs where the admission requirements are less rigorous, or residents maybe aren't quite as talented, it remains to be seen.
All right, I know we're going to see more about this, but I still got kind of a chuckle out of it, I have to admit.
The interesting thing you didn't mention was the attending physicians thought there was a higher quality of care. Like, the more I'm involved, the better it is, but the studies didn't prove that.
Let us turn then to the final one, which is from the American Cancer Society. Are we going to expand or reduce the age at which colorectal cancer screening should take place?
This is a thorough, extensive review by the American Cancer Society and doing a colorectal cancer screening update for what are called average risk adults. Recommendations are changing. What has been noticed over the last several decades is that men and women are developing colorectal cancer at a younger age now than they were several decades ago. So the American Cancer Society is now recommending that colorectal cancer screening begin at age 45. They call that a qualified recommendation. Qualified meaning it's not as strong for people that are already of 50 because the data aren't quite as good, but they feel pretty convinced. And especially in the higher risk groups, African Americans and Native Americans, they develop it even earlier than Caucasians and Hispanics. The other recommendations, over the age of 85, they don't recommend routine screening. They recommend routine screening up till age 75. And between 75 and 85, they say you got to individualize it according to the patient. They didn't pick a particular test. They said, listen, there are several different ones. Some are stool-based tests and some are visual tests. You should let the patient pick whichever test they want. It varies according to how regularly you use it. For example, the stool-based test, if you do fecal immunochemical testing or DNA testing, that's done every 1 to 3 years. If you do a visual test, CT scan or colonoscopy, that's done every 5 to 10 years. But they say the most important thing is to get a test. And if the fecal test is positive, then follow that up with a visual imaging test.
Definitely a lot of change going on here. I know it's a major public health concern. Why are we seeing this increased rate of colorectal cancer among younger folks?
Elizabeth, the answer is not really clear. Whether that's related to environment or nutrition, it's not really known. It has been described. We do need to figure that out. Why this is incredibly important is there are cancers that are preventable. Colorectal cancer is, because it starts out usually as a polyp. And if the polyp is removed, you remove that precancerous lesion, you prevent the cancer, and it's been clearly shown to improve survival.
Great message. On that note, that is the one I will discuss this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.